ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
The best design? You never notice it. The kettle, the beanbag, the umbrella. They look the way they do because someone somewhere made a decision and that decision stuck. What does that say about them? And what does it say about us? The objects all around you have a story. Hear them on By Design with me, Anthony Burke. Search By Design on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Late Night Live, coming to you from Gadigal Land. I'm Tracy Holmes, filling in for David Marr. 40 years on, the Soweto uprising remains a defining moment in South Africa's anti-apartheid struggle. It began with the government's decision to impose Afrikaans as the language of instruction in black schools, an act that exposed how education, language and control were tightly bound together. Students took to the streets in protest. Police responded with lethal force, and the images that emerged shocked the world, accelerating global opposition to apartheid. Later in the program, we'll hear from one of the young activists who led those protests in 1976. But first, deep in the rainforests of Papua New Guinea winds the Sepik River. It's one of the largest unpolluted freshwater systems in the Asia-Pacific region, and it's rich with crocodiles, eels, turtles, prawns, and fish. For the nearly 500,000 people the river sustains, it's also home to water spirits like Sambrak, the rainbow snake, and Sukundimi, a living spirit and guardian of the river. For developers, there are other riches. The land along the river holds billions of dollars worth of copper and gold, and an Australian-based company is on the verge of securing a mining lease after decades of exploration. A new documentary charts the Sepik people's rise to protect the river from the enormous project. Sukundimi Walks Before Me stars Emmanuel Penny. He's director of the PNG NGO Project Sepik and a co-producer of the film. Manu joins me in the studio. With him also is Theonila Roka-Matbob. And Nila is a former PNG MP and a Bougainville activist. She's the winner of the 2026 Goldman Environmental Prize for her work getting Rio Tinto to take responsibility for the damage wreaked by their Panguna mine. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you for having us here.
Manu, I'll start with you. If you take us to the river, if we were there today, what would we see?
You would not be able to see a Coke can, a Coke plastic. You won't be able to see processed food, processed things from factories. It'll be just the river and everything around it as natural and flowing. It'll be quiet. There'll be no noise, no humming of the refrigerator, sound of the vehicle, horn or anything. It'll be still and it'll be the living memory of our ancestors.
So it's pristine.
It's pristine, it's intact, and it's an iconic river of the Pacific, the region Asia Pacific, and one of the last remaining intact freshwater ecosystem of the world.
Yeah, I think that's incredible when you put it into that kind of category. And what about the people who live along the river and their connection to it?
The people are industrious. They're hardworking, they're creative, they're innovative. They strongly hold on to their way of life and their innate role as guardians of the river. When we're born knowing that this river is ours and that we belong to the river, the forests, the swamps, the marshes, the tributaries, the lakes, that all makes up our home. We don't see it as an environment. We don't see it as resource. We only see our home and we see ourselves in the river and everything around it.
So if I just let people know, the Frida River Project is a fourfold project worth about $200 million, a copper gold project, a large open cut mine, the Frida River Hydroelectric Project to power the mine, the CPIC infrastructure project, roads, ports, bridges, an airstrip, etc., and the CPIC power grid project. And I suppose that's what they argue, that they're going to bring the people of the river, is this infrastructure. How do people feel about that, the promises of schools, hospitals, power lines and airport?
The people along the river are highly educated and informed by all the promises that were given to Pogara, given by people of in Oktedi, at Tolukuma Mines, at Ramu Nickel, and in Bougainville. And so that mistrust in the government itself, and that suspiciousness or that mistrust also, and disbelief to corporations who only see profit as the means to an end, has given them enough confidence to say they do not believe any of that. The other great thing about the people along the CPIC River is that a lot of them in several villages have worked in Pogara. They've worked as geologists, engineers, scientists, administrators in Pogara, in Oktedi and Bougainville. And we only had to show up and they said, hey, look, I worked in Bougainville. I packed my stuff and ran away when this happened. It's not going to happen in my home. So it was not just us, an NGO moving in to inform people. They were informing themselves and they carry that resistance.
So the other mines that you mentioned and the ones, the names that we're familiar with, how would you compare the size of the Frida project compared to those that came before?
I want to compare Frida with the others. The Frida mine is promised to be the largest in Papua New Guinea, probably one of the largest in the Pacific. And so the chances of this benefiting the country is enormous. However, the people are still suspicious. They're not confident that the government and the company can deliver what they promised to deliver.
Now, one of the arguments in favour of the mine is not just about gold, but it's about the role of copper in powering renewable energy. Let's just hear a short clip from the film.
What's the future of the world going to look like? They're making electric cars. They're making electric planes too now. So the whole world is moving to renewable energy, perhaps. One light vehicle that's running on electricity or batteries or whatever is going to need about 250 kilograms of very pure copper. The market forces in the world plus our needs are going to get someone to open Frida, whether we like it or not.
So that's the governor of East CPIC province, Alan Bird, addressing a community meeting in Papua New Guinea about the proposed gold and copper mine on the CPIC River. Manu, what do you make of his argument that the development of this mine is inevitable?
Project CPIC and a lot of people from CPIC itself and Papua New Guinea, like I said, are practical people. We understand that the government needs income from export. We also understand that we cannot stop this mine, but we also know our power to delay the mine so that we find the right people and the right technology to build it. While the good governor of East CPIC, Alan Bird, has explained that we also understand that we have several arguments. One of our arguments is that there are no electric cars in Papua New Guinea. Why do we have to sacrifice our lives for electric cars in Australia and America? Why can't Australia, America, New Zealand or elsewhere find their own copper in their own home and build their electric cars? Why do we have to sacrifice our home, our only home, and our lives is at stake to give electric cars to the world. We have other ways of getting foreign exchange or improving our foreign exchange. It doesn't have to, it can be copper, but not at CPIC, because the place where the mine is proposed to be built is probably one of the last places in the world where a mine should be built. Why? Because it's one of the most seismically active places in the world. The soil morphology, the morphology of the river itself, and the high rainfall makes it impossible for any scientist in the world to come to conclusion that it's a safe place to build a mine or any infrastructure, including a dam. Mm.
Tracy Holmes in the LNL chair for David Marr, and with me is Manu Penny from Project CPIC, along with Bougainville activist Theonila Roca Matbob. Nila, I'll come to you in a moment. I have not forgotten you. But I want to talk about or get an understanding of what the key issues are in the project, the main worries specifically about the tailings, and you mentioned it just previously about the construction of the dam itself. What are the major concerns around that?
Our first and foremost concern was the possibility of the dam to break, given where we are on the Ring of Fire and how it's one of the most seismically active places in the world. We were also surprised, and we also knew about corporate tactics and corporate bully, because when the company submitted the environmental impact statement, it chose not to include the environmental the dam break analysis, and it has to take us more than 4 years to argue, even using the Organization for Economic Cooperation's conflict or mediation process through the Australian government's NCP, the National Contact Point, to demand and get them to release the dam break analysis. That says so much about the company and so much about the risks. Mm-hmm. Why would they hide the document or tactically exclude the document to make it public? And even to this date, not a lot of people have seen that document. That would be the main risk, would be the possibility of the dam break, which is highly likely. Number two would be, even before any kind of infrastructure is built, they have to clear the place. The overburden, all of those, the trees, the soil, the rocks, where will it go? It will displace the water, and so we won't have a river. We will just have a floodplain. It's just massive water all over the place. And we will also lose the riverbeds with sedimentation. So it's a huge risk even before anything is built or during the time of building. The other risk is the risk of a civil war, because already even after the government in 2025, in December, gave the environmental permit, the people already talking to each other publicly and not publicly about organizing a war. And the CPICs will say, if we had Bougainville, the CPICs will be bigger than Bougainville. So why we want to follow the rules of engagement? We want to follow the rules of conversation, communication, dialogue, and say, where are you at this and how safe is this? If the government and the company is unwilling to give all the or make all information public, all documentation public, and not willing to listen to the people, then there is a possibility of that, and it could be really messy. We could lose lives. That's another risk. The other risk would be the deforestation. At the time of building, it just opens up that forest, and that forest makes up a large portion of all the rainforest in Papua New Guinea, which is the third largest rainforest in the world. So we are providing the world the breathing lungs. And so the huge risk would be to lose those forests. And that will you know, impact climate change, impact changes in weather, and also greatly affect the river and the lives of the people.
Mm. I'm going to give you a rest. Neela, I'm coming to you. You were an MP for Bougainville, where Rio Tinto had the Panguna mine. What happened to the environment around that mine?
Well, the environment around the mine, which is obviously a toxic legacy or a devastating legacy that we have, I mean, we live on and have obviously inherited from Rio Tinto's activity, is something that we're now permanently living with. I mean, the devastating legacy was the reason why Bougainville went into conflict. So that was the reason why I got into politics.
And how did you do it? How did you take on this mine and the owners of the mine and all of the other powerful groups that you had to encounter? And what lessons do you think you bring to the people of the CPIC?
It took a lot of learning for me to really understand the rules of engagement, because having a corporate company on Bougainville in a cultural context is already a cross-cultural, you know, situation where you got to understand rules of engagement on all sides. So it took me really 7 years to kind of collect stories, sit with the church, all the different stakeholders, the leaders, the storytellers, the elderly people who actually saw the trees, you know, going down, the river getting polluted. So I wanted to imagine, because I was not born in that era where I could see the breaking down of the ecosystem and the termination of life. So that took a lot of internal preparation and also a lot of wisdom from our amazing, like, you know, elders in the communities. And from there, like, you know, I think in 2000, that more or less, like, growing up, it was sort of a part of me, especially when you inherit a very controversial portion of a territory. Like, that's already a differentiation that does not, like, you know for sure that you're living on something that's not normal.
I'm really interested when you talk about those rules of engagement, and you have to learn a whole new different language, a whole new thinking with the people that you're engaging with. And I'm conscious that this often happens to the people who are going to suffer the most. Do you think there was an equal understanding of different thinking and different way of life and a different discussion from the other side?
I'll put it this way, like, it's easy to understand the other side, the corporate side and the culture and the engagement, because, you know, that side is very precise, right? And you know that whatever you're reading on book is final. But when it comes to our side, like, you know, back in the indigenous community space, we are people who kind of, I call us eye context people, where we're very complex that if I say yes, that yes has layers in them. Like, I gotta understand the facial reaction when I'm getting that yes, because that yes might come with 3 or 4 conditions, and mostly it will not be spoken about. It's like, will I need to give a yes with a silence or a yes with a parable? Super complicated. So that is where, like, you know, understanding my own people took 7 years alone to understand and do a lot of, I should also say, as a way of strategy, we founded a rehabilitation center, because in order for me to understand the unspoken impacted community, I needed to have an organized community of young children, because children are the only ones through whom you can read the soul of their parents, because they speak it.
Manu, coming back to you, I understand that you took your concerns to the OECD via a contact point in Australia. They found Pan-Aust did not breach any OECD guidelines, and this is the company that's going to be doing the Frida mine. Now the company's been granted its environment permit, What's your response to that?
I think at the time the negotiations were going, the investigation was going to confirm our complaints, they did find that the company did not, one of our grievances was it did not include the dam break analysis. And toward the conclusion of that investigation, the company ended up putting out that dam break analysis. One of the other decision was, and then right to the end, the NCP or the National Contact Point in Australia concluded that our grievance or our complaint on the lack of free, prior and informed consent could not be validated. We still believe, and the film tomorrow on the 11th of June in Australia will show to the world that we still believe that we did not give consent. We continue to believe that the very basic standards set out by UN and one or two laws in Papua New Guinea does not adequately give meaning and definition to the kind of consultation, conversation that our indigenous ways allows us to. And given that Papua New Guineans in general and people along the river lack the information on or even a mental image of what a mine looks like, they can't even know the size of the wheels of the trucks that will be carrying. No one can. Even I cannot. And I've graduated from a university. So for us to not have those mental pictures, how can we give consent?
So the company says it consulted widely with the community. They say they've got consent from the community. Are they confusing consultation with consent?
The company not understand how Melanesians, indigenous people, consult. They think that the images they give to people and anyone who's crowding around in their photographs or one person that stands up and say, yeah, let me ask you this question, or I think that's okay, is consent. Mm. But overwhelmingly, if there is an independent consultation or independent investigation is to be carried out from the headwaters all the way down to the delta of the Sipik, just like the Sukundimi Declaration, it will clearly show that we do not give consent. And the overwhelming feeling is that we will never give social license to this.
So just as we wind towards the close, can you tell us a bit more about the Sukundimi Declaration?
The Sukundimi Declaration was born out of the Narokobian philosophy. Late Bernard Narokobi, a doctor of law and a philosopher, wrote many books and has been the champion of the Melanesian ways. He was also the champion of forming and shaping the constitution of Papua New Guinea, the organic law, and several other important legal legislative pieces that allows Papua New Guineans, allows us to be completely Melanesian, to be completely Papua New Guinean, and express ourselves as such and be able to argue in the court of law that this is our way. The government, the constitution, also acknowledges that in the Land Act, in the customary law, customary land act, and the underlying law act, and several other legislative instruments. So knowing that all the nations along the Sipik River did not cede their sovereignty, today, my village can only make laws on land, lakes, tributaries, and our forest, and no other villages can come and tell us that what we did is correct or wrong. That's how independent each villages are along the Sepik River. Understanding that and understanding the power of our constitution and the laws, we ventured to go and collect, to have a collective voice of all the nations from the headwaters of Sepik all the way down to the Sepik Delta and saying, these are sovereign nations. They have House Tambaran. The House Tambaran is their governance. If we gather them together, ask them, what do you want, the mine or not? And so that's how Supreme Sukundimi was designed, based on all of that. And that's how Supreme Sukundimi was signed on by 28 House Tambaran. But today, all other House Tambarans and all other villages have supported this. Several more villages have come together and stand beside the 28 and say, we want our names and our signatures to be part of the Supreme Sukundimi Declaration.
Can you explain what House Tambaran is?
The House Tambaran, in my language, it's called Ngego. It's really our administrative implementation and governance and leadership, where every decisions are made there. A lot of people or anthropologists who have studied that, who are not from Papua New Guinea, would say it's a house man where only men goes in. Physically, you can see only men go there. But the decisions are also made by everyone. The women are called the elders, and the men are called the younger population or the younger citizens. And so decisions are made by the women first, and the men agree in the House Tambaran. So the House Tambaran is our governance, provides leadership, and provides the spiritual element of the people.
Kanila, can I just ask you, having been through what you've been through, do you think there's still a chance that this mine could be stopped?
They have all the community power to be able to stop the mine because, I mean, for me, I am willing and ready to honestly engage with these people because they do not know what they're going to be getting themselves into, because my present, if they do not take care of that, will be their future. And it comes with a price of irreversible social patterns.
Well, joining me in the studio has been Emmanuel Manu-Penny, director of PNG NGO Project CPIC and co-producer of the film Sukundimi Walks Before Me. Alongside him, Theonila Rocker-Matbob, former PNG MP and Bougainville activist, winner of the 2026 Goldman Environmental Prize. Sukundimi Walks Before Me is going to screen at the Sydney Film Festival on June 11 and 13, ahead of a cinema release in late 2026. Manu and the film directors will all be in attendance in Sydney for a Q&A session after the film. Coming up on Late Night Live, the protests that changed South African history. Next week marks 50 years since the Soweto Uprising, June 16, 1976. At that time, Soweto was a black township under apartheid rule in South Africa. Thousands of students took to the streets to protest against the South African government's decision to make Afrikaans a teaching language in black schools. After police opened fire on protesters, at least 200 students were killed. The demonstrations grew into a larger uprising across South Africa. The event became a powerful symbol of resistance to apartheid and helped build pressure that eventually led to its end in 1994. Joining me now from Johannesburg in South Africa is Professor Noor Niftegodian, head of the History Workshop at the University of Witwatersrand, and Seth Mazabuko, activist, former teacher, and one of the student leaders in the uprising. Welcome to both of you. Thanks for joining Late Night Live.
Thank you for inviting us.
Oh, absolute pleasure. I'm going to start with you, Noor. How is it that a language policy sparked one of the most significant protests in South African history?
Thanks very much, Tracy. When the protesters marched on June 16th, there were several slogans centered on a rejection of Afrikaans as a medium of instruction, as well as the slogan of Black Power. And those two slogans are critically important to understand why it was that the imposition of Afrikaans as a medium of instruction triggered what you correctly characterize as a national protest that started in Soweto, but spread across the country and marked a decisive turning point in the struggle against apartheid. Afrikaans was part of the system of Bantu education, which was introduced in the mid-1950s. And the primary objective of that education system, which was a cornerstone of the entire apartheid system, was to keep Black people and African people in particular in conditions of oppression and as subjects. In fact, the architects of the of Bantu education were quite explicit that education for African students was aimed at keeping them in conditions of servility, that they should not be able, even though they were getting educated, to rise above certain forms of labor. In a sense, to put it more explicitly in the language of the apartheid system, Black people in general and African people in particular had to serve the needs of white people. So when from 1974, the apartheid government began to insist that Afrikaans had to be a medium of instruction, it immediately generated opposition. First of all, what one had from the late 1960s and especially in the 1970s was a massive expansion of the school-going population. In fact, you know, when the Bantu education was introduced in the mid-1950s, there were just under a million African students in formal schooling. By 1976, that figure had increased to just over 3 million. And what it represented was a sea change in the education of African children. And many young people, including people like Seth, were deeply committed to education. There was a strong desire to use education as a means to go beyond what the parents of those children were able to achieve. And in a sense, education was seen as one important means of transcending the barriers that apartheid had placed on Black people as part of the oppressive system. Secondly, the post-Sharpeville period, this is 1960, so the 1960s was regarded as a period of high apartheid. This was when the apartheid system was at its height. White privilege, white standards of living increased exponentially. So there was an arrogance by the apartheid states and white people in particular. And so one must see the imposition of Afrikaans as part of this ideological hubris by the apartheid government. And it was really explained by one of the ministers, right, that African students had to learn the language of their oppressors, especially those in the urban areas, meaning Black people in the urban areas, had to be able to speak English and Afrikaans, because those were the languages of the white masses. And in particular, the rationale was that when instructions are issued by white masters, African people had to understand it, but in the language of the masters. So what one sees here is this ideological arrogance of the white regime being imposed on young Black people who were aspiring to transcend the oppressive system of apartheid. Mm. And then let me just add very quickly two points, because Afrikaans was, in a sense, a trigger for the protest. But there were underlying structural problems, both in education and in Black townships more generally. In education, as I said earlier, There was a massive expansion of the African school-going population, and the state did not build sufficient schools to keep up with that massive expansion. So that by the mid-1970s, the student per teacher ratio was something just under 60 students per teacher. Schools were overcrowded. Under 2% of teachers had a university degree. So the system itself was under enormous pressure and in crisis. And that crisis in the schools reflected a broader crisis, in the townships and of African life. Yeah, townships had become overcrowded and were straining under the pressure of various structural crises.
Yeah, absolutely. And many people don't know also that, the authority was so adamant that the majority of the people be kept in this oppressed state that even television wasn't allowed during that period, and there was no TV in South Africa. But Seth, I'm going to come to you now. Why was it so important for you to get out onto the streets and demonstrate on that June day in 1976?
Thank you. A lot of anger amongst us young people and children, because we were not the first group, but just about the group or the cohort that was now to be used as a model to then introduce Afrikaans on top of all the frustrations that were there within the education system. And we were, most of us, if not all of us, were born out of the Black Consciousness movement and philosophy, and which actually explicitly came out to say, look, Black men, you are on your own. We had slogans also that the Steve Biko said we need to actually even free ourselves psychologically. He was very open about this, that now the oppressor will always deal with the mind of the oppressed. So to us as students, under, of course, the banner of Black Consciousness, we're able to say this whole introduction of Afrikaans is not only an isolated case, it is an agenda and the project of the government. And we're clear, we knew, even for that matter, when we're still in that age, that if we deal with this crack, we crack the pillar of apartheid or the pillar of Bantu education, just give it a crack, it will make that pillar to fall. And that the falling of that pillar will make sure that apartheid is shaken. And let me tell you, Hello?
No, keep going, please.
Yeah. To us, as the leaders of 1976, every June 16 is not another year, now the 50th anniversary. It is pain. Many of us have not gone through healing. Many of us are still in our minds, still taken into the pain of having led children out of the classroom only to be killed by white police. Mm. That to us, many of us, sits with us emotionally. Mm. We lost the days of our youth. Let's not forget that. We lost a great deal of family, support. We lost all those things because I was taken at the age 16. I was taken into solitary confinement for 18 years. I was detached and made to be away from my parents for 7 years. I mean, that age is the age I needed more of my family, my parents, and everyone. But I was taken through torture. I was taken through a lot of fire. So it must be understood in that now, even in this 50th anniversary of June 16, the emotions of June 16 sit right at the core.
Yes, I can hear that, Seth. Thank you very much for taking us there. The protest was supposed to be peaceful. It wasn't. The police opened fire, as Seth has detailed. But then how did that moment transfer into what we see as an army of resistance across South Africa?
Yes, this is actually quite interesting. You know, the march was intended from the beginning by the organizers to be peaceful. In fact, young people, they sang freedom songs, they sang hymns, they sang jingles from the radio. So there was no sense amongst the students that this peaceful march would end up as a violent riot. But of course, what happened was the very act of tens of thousands of students leaving the precincts of their schools to take to the streets disrupted the control by the apartheid system of the townships, and particularly of the streets and other public spaces. This was why when students marched to one part of Soweto called Orlando and gathered in their numbers, the police immediately acted to stop that. And as you said, fired tear gas and live bullets into the crowd. And again, you know, the interviews that we've conducted show very clearly that when the volley of shots were, led to the deaths of, several students and injured many more, there was immediately an important shift in consciousness that happened. And the way that a number of people have expressed it was this. When they started the march on June the 16th, in the morning of June the 16th, they were against Afrikaans. By the time the police had shot people, students drew the conclusion that they now had to fight against the entire system of apartheid. That shift in consciousness was fundamental. And in fact, it is perhaps more than anything else, the turning point in the anti-apartheid struggle. And what was critical in this, you mentioned early on that South Africa did not have television until 1975, and then it was rolled out nationally at the beginning of 1976. So the media, in fact, becomes very important. And the critical image is that taken by a very well-known photographer, Sam Zima, of the dying body of Hector Peterson, who was one of the first victims of the police killings. And that image was transmitted across the country in newspapers, but also across the world. And that picture, more than anything else, engendered anger, sadness, but also produced acts of solidarity almost immediately. Within a day, there were protests in different parts of the country, over a few weeks, in other key metropolitan areas. So it was the actions of the police, more than anything else, in trying to stop violently the peaceful protests by the students in Soweto that in fact triggered a national protest, not only against Bantu education, but against the entire apartheid system.
Mm. You're listening to Late Night Live, and we're talking about next week's anniversary, the 50th anniversary of the Soweto Uprising in South Africa. My guests are Seth Mazibuko, one of the student leaders at the time, a former teacher and activist, and Professor Noor Niftagodian, South African Research Chair in Local Histories, Present Realities, and Head of the History Workshop at the University of the Witwatersrand. Seth, we just heard Noor talking about the images that then went around the world and really galvanised the impact of the uprising. How did the government's handling of it affect their credibility both within South Africa and abroad? And were you conscious of that support internationally?
That picture of Hector Peterson shook the world, and it was just a picture taken by a South African in a South African a situation. But when it reached out to the world, it then intensified the struggle against apartheid.
Yes, you talk about the impact of sport and politics and, various other boycotts, both economically as well. And I've spoken to a number of sporting superstars at the time who went to South Africa to see for themselves what was happening. And it is that has convinced them that, Australian teams should also be boycotting South African teams because of the situation that was happening there. And of course, our political leaders at the time were also engaged and voting in support of the UN declaration against the apartheid regime. So, Seth, I'm wondering, when majority rule arrived in 1994 and we see Nelson Mandela elected as the first black president of South Africa, did it feel to you like the fulfillment of what you were fighting for back in 1976?
The release of Nelson Mandela and other leaders, the beginning of negotiations and detained what was then called CODESA 1, 2, and 3. To us, when that process was taking place, and of course, 1994, the birth of then the New South Africa, and then later on, the birth of the Constitution. Oh, by the way, that is also having its 30th anniversary this year. We thought something was coming out that was then what we might have said it meet some of the demands we're making, you know, the issue of decolonization of education, the issue of economic empowerment, the issue of the land. But only later did we realize that there were a lot of compromises that came out of these negotiations, and these compromises were mostly expected from Black people. And in South Africa, when you talk reconciliation, it's like, for instance, you're only talking about Black people must just decide to forget and just move on. All these things put together are things that we're saying when we started with these negotiations, the release of Mandela and all that, we thought something good was going to come out of it. I say this all the time, I usually refer to 1976 as the battle of the book versus the bullet, and that resulted into blood. And the one thing that came out of that blood and that battle is that now we can now use the ballot instead of the bullet to be able to fight the ills that we're faced with. But at the same time, there are still questions that are not answered. There are still those goals and wishes that we had that are not answered, and we are not near them. We only know that now we can only use the ballot to remove people from positions or to put people from. But what those do after that is a serious one. Mm. So the dream is the dream deferred.
Noor, I'm going to come to you on this because having researched this so closely and looking into how the past has impacted the present, how do you then respond to somebody like Elon Musk, who has gone to the USA and is now sprouting a different version of history, or at least a present, and referring to history? How do you respond to some of the things he says about the country?
One can't really respond to Elon Musk and his ilk with anything less than complete contempt. You know, Elon Musk represents a conservative political view, which has always despised the idea of democracy and black majority rule in South Africa and other parts of the continent. Having benefited from the exploitation of black people over many decades, his family became super wealthy as a consequence of the interest in the mining industry, which has been historically at the center of the economic and therefore socio-political inequalities in South Africa. More pertinently, the myth that Elon Musk, Donald Trump, and that cohort are espousing around the idea of a white genocide is intended to impose policies on South Africa by propagating a complete lie. Most South Africans are completely shocked and surprised by the idea that the myth of white genocide has gained traction within the upper echelons of the Trump regime, promoted by the likes of Elon Musk. Mm. So I think that there's no other response, really. And most South Africans, you know, understand the politics of the Trump regime and the way that Elon Musk operates in those circles. And one must draw a very sharp separation between the ideological economic interests pursued by the likes of Elon Musk and Trump. Elon Musk would like us to believe, and this is no different from the colonial mindset that led to the disposition of land, that black people can't rule. Black people don't have the ability to manage a country. And what they want to see is, in fact, a return to the dominance of the white minority. That is the agenda. So our criticism of what is wrong in our country bears no resemblance to what the likes of Elon Musk are saying. As a closing remark on this particular matter, align myself with the broad analysis that Seth has put forward, which is that we celebrate our democracy, we celebrate our constitution, we celebrate the fact that in our country we can speak openly about all sorts of matters. We can, in fact, openly criticize our government. I would suggest that there are probably very few places in the world where people can, on a daily basis, sharply criticize everyone in government, from the president down to the local councillor, in very sharp language. There's no risk of people being imprisoned in the way that Seth and his generation was imprisoned for objecting to Afrikaans and apartheid in the 1970s. That is not on the cards. So we celebrate that, but we also are not resting on our laurels. When we see that there are problems, we speak out, we organize, we mobilize, we try to change policy, we try to change the way that the government is working. And that is very fundamentally different from the likes of what Elon Musk are trying to do.
That's very important to hear. Seth, how will you spend June 16, the anniversary day?
Oh, God. Oh, God. This year, being the 50th anniversary, where the police stopped us and killed us on June 16, we are starting a march from there. And then that march will connect to Hector Peterson Museum, where we are going to have a 50 seconds of a moment of silence. And we have also the ringing of the bells by churches for 50 seconds. And then from there, we're laying the wreath at Hector Peterson. Then we start the march to Orlando Stadium, and where it was destined to, the march was destined. And then we're also going to be then lighting a torch. And that torch, it is us, the veterans, the older guys, handing over that torch to the younger generation. We are going to hand over the torch to the generation of the Fees Must Fall movement. And then from there, the Fees Must Fall movement will pass on the torch again to the younger generation. And we are also going to be making a very strong call. One, we are going to be coming out strongly against alcohol, the level of alcohol in our, just today, this morning, I was listening, University of Cape Town came up with a shocking statistics of the level of alcohol in our communities. We're taking that also up as an issue. We're taking up an issue on hunger. We are also having a partnership of the Union Against Hunger. We're taking up that. And we are also going to be having the third issue being the active citizenry, particularly by young people, particularly that we're also getting to elections this year. So those are the three critical issues, but the whole process will be taking up the issues that, because of the killings of our people and stopping of the march, we could not take up. So we are completing that march, and we are also handing over the torch to the younger generation.
Well, it sounds like a hugely significant way to mark a very special anniversary. Seth Mazabuko, activist, former teacher, and one of the student leaders in the Soweto uprising 50 years ago next week, and Professor Noor Niftagodian, head of the history workshop at the University of the Witwatersrand. His book, The Soweto Uprising, The Birth of a National Students' Movement, has just been released. Thank you both so much for your time.
Thank you very much. God bless. Bye.
And that's the show. Tomorrow, Biljana Plavsic became the only woman convicted for mass atrocities in the Bosnian War. Still alive, in her 90s, an Australian law professor meets her face to face. Catch you then.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.